Hi, I'm Rachel Michelle Wilson. I'm a children's book author and illustrator, and I'd rather sit at the kid table than anywhere else.
You can sit with me. You can sit with me. You can sit with me at the kid table.
Oh, hi there. How is your February going? You know, I thought February would feel less sloggy than January, but I've struggled all month to do basic things like eat and sleep. It's times like these that I need to remind myself to take life a little less seriously and enjoy the small moments, which brings me to the kid table vibe of the week. Things that sound made up but aren't. Have you ever heard of restless leg syndrome? It sounds super fake. I wish it was, but it is very real, and unfortunately, I have the genes for it, which means I often can't fall asleep until 3 in the morning. Womp womp. I like to imagine back in the olden days before 1995, when the diagnosis became official, when my ancestors were trying to describe what was happening to them, and nobody believed them because it sounds absolutely ridiculous, like, my leg just feels like it has to move all the time, right when I'm about to fall asleep, like it has a mind of its own. It hurts, but not like a normal pain, like an irritating pain on the inside of my leg and the bottom of my foot. One time, I was on a flight and I had to take my shoes off because they were making my feet feel claustrophobic and my leg feel jumpy. Also, I wanted to take my pants off because that helps it feel better, but I didn't. I mean, imagine how that last one would go. So yeah, that's how it feels, and lately it has been really bad. I see you playing your tiny violin, and yes, like my ancestors before me, I have to take my pajama pants off because they are making my legs feel jumpy. I see you abruptly stop playing your tiny violin, unsubscribe from this newsletter and podcast, and leave the room. All this to say, you can blame the lack of sleep for this absolutely unhinged podcast episode. Anyway, thanks for the space to chuckle about it. On a hopeful note, after not being able to fall asleep until 7 in the morning, it sucked, I finally tried melatonin again, which hadn't worked at all for me as a teenager, but actually helped this time. I feel like a new person. Please keep your fingers crossed super tight that this continues to work on a regular basis and resets my rhythms and all that jazz. This week at my desk, I got to review the proofs for How to Pier Pants the Right Way, my debut book, and they look so good. Thanks to all those who have celebrated this book with me so far, it means a lot, and some of you have even pre-ordered copies already, which means the world to me and actually helps me look good to my publisher. So thank you again. This week at the kid table, we're sitting with children's book author Margaret Wise Brown. But before we dive into that, I just wanted to let you know that though I've appreciated all that I've learned from the super thorough studies of children's book creators that I've been doing, they've taken a lot out of me. So I'm simplifying just a bit. Instead of collecting a million things and putting it into this giant long post, I'm just going to focus on like 3 to 5 things I've learned, which will reduce the podcast episodes to around 10 minutes-ish. It's meant to be like a quick dose of kid table vibes and creative inspiration. I'm a bit nervous about this shift, to be honest, as these long posts were my most popular and most shared, but I hope you will also like the more bite-sized version, especially because I know you are busy and listening to the long podcast is quite the commitment. All right, on to learning from the great Margaret Wise Brown. You probably know Margaret Wise Brown for Goodnight Moon and The Runaway Bunny, but you may not know that she had a well-known feud with famous children's librarian Anne Carol Moore, who actually hated Goodnight Moon and actively advocated against it, or that she was heavily influenced by Gertrude Stein, whom she later helped publish a children's book called The World is Round, or that she was engaged to a Rockefeller when she tragically passed away at the early age of 42. She is one of the most intriguing people in children's books, and I can't wait to give you just a glimpse of her fascinating life and point of view. Let's start with a few fun facts and anecdotes. She was born in 1910, which is not a super fun fact, but it's important to give you an idea of the timeline. She worked at the Bank Street Experimental School, where she researched language, specifically repetition and sensory details, which you've probably noticed in her books. Goodnight Moon was not a huge hit when it was first published, but became a word-of-mouth sensation over time. I found this description that I love. Brown thought the book was successful because it helped children let go of the world around them piece by piece, just before turning out the light and falling asleep. Brown loved fur, like really loved it, which inspired her book Little Fur Family, illustrated by Garth Williams. In the picture book, The Important Thing About Margaret Wise Brown, written by Mac Barnett, the illustrator Sarah Jacoby created bunny characters for parts of that book because Brown loved a woman named Michael Strange, her writer pen name, and they called each other Little Bun in their letters. One of my favorite moments in the book, which I included an illustration in the newsletter, is when Brown celebrates a success by buying an entire cart worth of flowers, and then she throws a party. An NPR feature described Brown's dramatic and tumultuous love affairs with both men and women, and her interesting relationship with her audience. Some say she didn't like children, which could be true, but as we learned from my previous post, Maurice Sendak also said he didn't like children, but then contradicted it in a million ways with all these other quotes and also how he treated children and how much he respected them. So it's kind of confusing. I'm not sure what the actual truth is, but either way, Brown was at the very least fascinated by children and was super in tune with her own childhood. Brown's death was very sudden and strange and sad. While in France, she had to get an ovarian cyst removed. After a few weeks, she was feeling better, and the nurse came in to check on her, and Brown kicked her leg up to show just how great she felt, which ended up dislodging an embolism in her limb that went straight to her brain. Months later, she passed away suddenly at the age of 42. Another interesting thing is that on Margaret Wise Brown's tombstone, she chose writer of songs and nonsense to describe her, which I thought was fun. So now I want to dive into three things I learned from her life, work, and creative process, now that we know her just a little bit through some fun facts and anecdotes. Number one, a great story is a combination of the predictable and unpredictable. In an article called From What Writers Can Learn from Goodnight Moon, Amy Bender says, Goodnight Moon does two things right away. It sets up a world, and then it subverts its own rules even as it follows them. It works like a sonata of sorts, but like a good version of the form, it does not follow a wholly predictable structure. Many children's books do, particularly for this age, as kids love repetition and the books supply it. They often end, as we expect, with a circling back to the start and a fun twist. This is satisfying, but it can be forgettable. Kids, people, also love depth and surprise, and Goodnight Moon offers both. This analysis rings true for me. I think I return to Goodnight Moon over and over again because of its combination of comfort and mystery. The following quote sums it up perfectly, and I discovered this quote and lots of other really good information in one of my all-time favorite articles about Margaret Wise Brown by the talented Taylor Sterling. If you haven't subscribed to her newsletter Moonbow, consider this a sign. Okay, this is the quote from Margaret Wise Brown. A book can make a child laugh or feel clear and happy-headed as he follows a simple rhythm to its logical end. It can jog him with the unexpected and comfort him with the familiar, lift him for a few minutes from his own problems of shoelaces that won't tie, and busy parents, and mysterious clock time, into the world of a bug, or a bear, or a bee, or a boy living in the timeless world of story. If I've been lucky, I hope I have written a book simple enough to come near to that timeless world. Number two, to write the truth, you must be in tune with the reality of your audience. In her essay, Writing for 5-Year-Olds, please read the whole thing if you can because it's amazing, Brown said that there is one final determiner or denominator that gives the writing truth or falseness, and that is the reality in which the writing is concerned. So what is a 5-year-old child's reality and concern, she asks. She said one way to know that answer is to connect with our inner 5-year-old. Here's a quote from her. If we are writing for these delights and interests of 5-year-olds, we must remember them and experience them in our stories. And another thing, no matter how important we know little kittens and steam engines to be to a 5-year-old, no one can ever write about them without a real love for them and familiarity with them in some form, actual or remembered. When I was learning about the children's book industry, I received a lot of advice like your books need to have trucks or boats or animals or bright colors because kids love those things. Some kids do love those things, but if I don't love them, I shouldn't write a story about them. My best work has happened when I find something I love that intersects with what a child loves, especially if it is what little Rachel loved. If we're not sure what a child loves, Brown encourages us to ask them, what do they play when they are alone? What do they laugh at? What makes them sad? And what do they want to know? These are the things to find out. These and any number of others are the leads to get from 5-year-olds themselves. I don't know about you, but I'm thinking that whole I don't like kids quote from that article is a bit more complicated. Number three, respect children's books as real literature. If you can't tell just how much Brown respects her reader, let's continue our journey through her wonderful essay. She says, "When a child reaches the age of 5, he is the sum total of all his younger experiences and discoveries in a brand new world. For the first time, he has the power of words, to use them and to hear them, to describe the things that his 5-year-old senses perceive. He has his feet firmly enough on the ground now to go bouncing off on the most hilarious flights of imagination and to sympathize with and be curious about situations not his own. Here, then, is a challenging age to write for." Isn't that quote great? I think children's books are treated like children are treated. When we dismiss children's books as something less than real literature, we also dismiss children. Brown asks, "And why should not a child's story submit to the same standards of good, honest writing as any real literature?" Margaret Wise Brown felt excited about her 5-year-old audience and considered them as intelligent an audience in rhythm and sound as the maddest poet's heart could desire. And doesn't an audience like that deserve our very best? A big thanks to Whiskey Geraldine for our podcast music, and Joanna, Marietta, Saki, and Angela for sponsoring this episode. To become a sponsor, you can upgrade to a paid newsletter subscription by going to rachelmichellewilson.substack.com. Thanks so much for sitting at the kid table with me today. Until next time, I'll save you a seat right next to me.